Welcome to Future Proof, the marketing podcast from Kantar and Said Business School, University of Oxford. In each episode, we speak to industry experts about the changing landscape of marketing, sharing evidence and inspiration for the future.
I'm Valeria Piaggio, SVP and Head of Identity and Inclusion Insights. I'm also the Global Lead for the Inclusion Practice at Kantar.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everyone. Delighted to have you join us today. We're joined today by Belinda Smith, CEO of Americas at M6, which is one of the fastest growing media agencies globally. She is the Global Diversity Ambassador for the World Federation of Advertisers, and she has been a diversity activist hitting up media and advertising organizations throughout her career. She is joining me today to discuss the issue of diversity and inclusion in media and in the advertising industry. Welcome, Belinda. Thank you for being with us.
Oh my goodness. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
We are honored to have you and we are eager to hear about yourself. Can you share a little bit about your journey?
Of course. I am a Black female CEO. I'm currently located in New York, so I'm set in the United States. My region for M6 is the Americas. So that's US, Canada, Central and South America, and our operations and clients across that region. I started my career actually brand side at AT&T. I started at a time, I guess, when digital was really just taking off. And one of the earlier things that I did at AT&T was actually a product-focused role, building out a programmatic advertising offering. And so a lot of times when people ask what I do, I will say I'm a programmatic buyer because that's how I came into the industry. And I think coming in that way has definitely shaped the experiences that I've had because my advertising career has been more tech than creative, which is important. So I started out brand side at AT&T. I've been at the IAB. I've run trading desk at another agency. Right before coming to M6, I was actually an M6 client. I led all of global media at Electronic Arts. And then I took some time off. And at the end of that time off, I find myself here at M6 and talking to you. I will say I am one of the global diversity ambassadors for the WFA, along with my friend Jerry Dakin. And I've been doing that since I was at EA. So I think going on 3 years now, and that's been a really exciting role, perhaps from my time when I was at the IAB. I really enjoy coalition building and things that span across the entire industry. And I think that's probably one thing that led me back to agency side is wanting to work more broadly across more businesses to have bigger impact.
Very impressive career. And I would love to go into, you mentioned, you know, the World Federation of Advertisers, who has just done a recent census. Can you talk a little bit about your role there and what the World Federation of Advertisers was aiming to do with a recent census?
Yes, you are going to have to cut me off because I could talk about this for the next 3 days. I cannot express enough gratitude towards the WFA for everything they were able to pull off. I feel like this is definitely a dream I've had in my heart for a long time. It was very difficult to do, but it's done and it's now live in the world, which is really exciting. So the Global DEI Census, which I think we took some liberties in calling it a census. That was kind of the branding stamp we put on it because we did get some nitpickers who said, well, this is not technically a census. And yes, of course we know that, but the Global DEI Census that we undertook was really to try to get a third-party quantitative and agnostic and public and transparent benchmark into how we are doing as an industry. And I think that it became a little easier. This was a very tough feat, but I think it became a little easier to do after all of the George Floyd protests, because that became a moment where our industry and brands once again pledged support to anti-Black racism and pledged support specifically in that moment towards Black Lives Matter. And so we saw another, I would say, peak of conversation around that topic. And being a Black consumer myself, agnostic of how I show up in this industry, these things happen. They punctuate throughout our lives where, you know, suddenly it's popular to acknowledge that racism exists and people say that they want to stop that from being the case, but we rarely see action on the other side of that. And so what we wanted to do tied to this moment was say, how can we encourage people to stay committed to the things that they said out loud? How can we encourage people to understand which actions have impact? How can we encourage people to have a healthy discussion about where we are, which doesn't feel defensive, I think is the important thing. And I think that's why it was important that this was a WFA effort and not an effort on, you know, behalf of a company or a brand. And so essentially the Global DEI Census is measuring the self-reported lived experiences of people within our industry all over the globe. And so this year we had more than 10,000 responses and we got a good read on inclusion within the workplace, lived experiences within the workplace. Do you feel like you belong? Do you feel like you can speak up? Do you feel like your voice and opinion matters at work? Does it meaningfully change the work that you do at your company, etc.? And so I think the way that Jerry and I have interacted with the WFA as diversity ambassadors, I've been really focused on internal change, and Jerry has been very focused on external representation, which is usually what do the ads look like and what does the creative look like. And I think it's probably easier for us to talk about that and to measure that because those are the artifacts that live out in the world that reflect what we do. But I think it is just as important, if not much more important, for us to think about, well, what are the organizations that produce this content and what do those organizations look like? And what is the experience that people who are not the majority in those organizations are having? And so that's what the Global DEI Census aspires to measure. The last thing I'll say on it is last year, I think we saw a trend of companies releasing their own DEI data. And I think there is inherent mistrust for many reasons when those numbers come out, you know, if we are only getting the information that tells a positive story. And so again, something that's really important for the Global Census is to say, listen, we don't have an angle in this game. We just want to report it as it is given to us. We're going to honor what people report as their lived experiences. And this is done in a fashion that rolls up at a country level and then globally. So it's not put out into the world to shame anyone, but actually the opposite, to really help people understand what the issues are and how we measure progress against that.
So you mentioned internal change. That is your remit. What is your assessment of the changes that are needed in the industry to provide a work environment for everyone to flourish?
There's a lot that's needed. There are complete changes to systems, which is how we discuss talent, how we support them, how we promote them, how we train them, how we evaluate them, how we find them, how we hire them. Changes to systems of how we communicate to our leaders what their jobs are and how we reward them for those jobs. And more specifically, I mean that my experience is it has been very rare to be in an organization where a leader is clearly told that they have the mandate of making a safe and healthy and inclusive team. And I think that should not only be something that we talk about, but that should be something that we pay for and that we compensate on. So I think that's very important. But also I think, you know, and this is where I see sometimes people getting either a little overwhelmed or deflated at the task, we fundamentally have to rethink our own beliefs and perspectives about work and about people and about value. So one example I'll give is when I talk about this with people, I try to not use the word minority. I try to not use the word marginalized, depending on what place you are in the world. So again, I'm set in the US and our language around diversity is very different than Europe, is very different than Asia, is very different than South America. But ultimately, I try to be really conscious to use language that does not other people who are not white. And a lot of what we have seen that hasn't worked in the DEI space are people viewing this as a moral issue or a charitable issue, which is to say, I feel a little guilty. I would hope that I personally don't contribute to racism. I'm going to do DEI because it is the right thing to do. Well, what that really means is I'm going to do DEI because it will make me personally feel less guilty for anything I think I might negatively be contributing to. And when you frame DEI as a moral issue or as the right thing to do, there are a couple of problems. One is not everyone believes that. And no one's going to stand up, and at least in my experience, and maybe because I'm a Black woman, but no one's going to stand up in a meeting and say, I don't think it's right to be inclusive. I don't think it's right to speak out against racism. But there are some people who think it doesn't have a place in the workspace. And so when you frame it as a moral issue, we're already on the wrong foot because we're not morally uniform. We're not morally the same person. And when we frame it as a moral issue, we also take the stance of those who are in power today are the model and those who are not are deficient. And there is something that they lack. And we are going to teach them how to be more like us so that they can fit in with us and they can be successful as we are. And that's the opposite of the point. The point is that we need to all shift our frame to be more inclusive. We need to all have different understandings of what it means to be a professional, of what it means to speak four languages, and therefore maybe your grammar in the fourth language isn't perfect, but that doesn't mean that you are not a high-performing, coveted talent. And so I like to think and talk about internal inclusivity because it is a fundamental overhaul of what we've known before, and also, and most importantly, if done correctly, does it improve the experiences of Black women? Absolutely. Does it improve the experiences of highly educated, well-connected, successful white men? Yes, it does. And so we need to think about it from the perspective of this is something that helps everyone. It's not a charitable effort geared at a certain population that you are doing out of the goodness of your heart. We need to think about it as this is the future of work, and this is how we all come together in this global world.
I'm curious to hear, you know, from your perspective, you've been in the industry for a very long time. When you got the results from these censuses, what was your reaction?
Listen, again, this is something that has been really important to me for a long time. And a huge part of that is because of who I am demographically and how I show up in a physical workspace and how people react to that. In addition, again, this was done and we really started making progress on this after George Floyd protest. And so I was also very eager to say, oh, this is great. We're going to run this survey and get all of these results around how anti-Black racism shows up in the workplace. We're going to finally be able to have a discussion about ethnicity because our industry is really good at circumventing that discussion so many times and saying things like, oh, let's just talk about diversity of thought. So I was like, we're going to have data. We're going to pin this down. We're actually going to have to confront it. And when the results came back, I'm not embarrassed to say that my first reaction was disappointment, because the biggest issue that actually popped up in the survey results were around gender. They were around women reporting worse lived experiences than men. They were around significant gender pay gaps. They were around women carrying the burden of what we'll call the caregiver tax. So if you were caring for elderly parents, as an example, or for children, a lot of that burden falling to women and being.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Seen as something that can be career limiting to them. And I think disappointment is a weird word, perhaps. But what I then reflected on after the number one issue not being, I have to deal with anti-Black racism, and thinking through, wow, this wasn't exactly what I expected. Now, the trends inside were what I expected. If you actually comb down further through the data and you compare ethnicity majorities versus ethnic minorities country by country, of course, you see worse lived experiences, etc. But when I thought about the biggest universal issue that we saw globally being attributed to gender, then my thought was, wait a second, haven't we been talking about gender for over a decade? Isn't that kind of crazy? Like, our industry has gone through its own Me Too movement. I can't count on all of my fingers and toes how many pledges, initiatives, organizations, mentorship circles, women exclusive executive clubs, things that for years and years and years have been directly aimed at leveling the playing field for women in the workplace and uplifting women in the workplace. And that's even one of the reasons that, you know, I didn't want it to be the biggest finding, because in my mind, I thought, we always talk about gender. Can we just get on to something else already? And this data was such a humbling experience of, no, we can't, because we still haven't made progress. Part of the importance of the global DEI census is for us to have a reality check, because I think if you were new to the industry, or maybe if you had been to a few panels, you would definitely think that gender was a thing of the past that's behind us. And it's not. It's here. And there are still tangible issues for how it impacts career, impacts your ability to earn a living, to take care of your family, et cetera. So I think that we have a lot of good data. There wasn't anything that came up that was striking as far as, oh, I couldn't have imagined that this was an issue. But there are enough things now that we at least have some kind of baseline against. So we have a top 10 takeouts, and I won't repeat all of them. Of course, the biggest things that came up were around gender, ethnic minorities, depending on what your region is. And there are some regions like APAC where actually there's a history in our industry of, you know, flying in white men from London into an Asian market, and all of the power rests with them and not the people who are born and of and from the market. And so the issue's kind of reversed in some places. But we did see that called out. We saw mental health concerns, which is people not feeling comfortable disclosing their mental health status. We saw concerns around sexual preference and orientation. And so all the things that we expected would show up did show up. But now we have a benchmark. And the goal is going to be, the goal has to be, to raise that benchmark, to make progress on making things better. And so what I hope we have now are a couple of years of experience within ethnicity, decades of experience within gender of things that we've done. We can say those things have gotten us to this point. If we want to get beyond this point, we've got to think differently, and we've got to be willing to do things differently. And so I hope that this can act both as a benchmark to check in on ourselves, but also as a constant agitation for us to do more and to be braver in what we are doing. Because what we've done, whether we felt it was brave or not, whether the press release sounded good or not, here we are still.
I know this is not part of your responsibilities, but I would love your reflections on the external representation as well, because advertisers have so much social impact.
I will talk about external, and you are going to be really impressed with how on brand I am, because I'm going to tie it right back to internal inclusion. You know, the thing I like to remind people often is advertising controls what we as a society deem as acceptable, period. And I have found that there are people who embrace that fact and they're energized by it, and therefore there is a responsibility and an importance that they give to their work because they know how powerful and how meaningful it is. And then I have found people who are running away from that truth and trying to minimize how powerful advertising is. But just to give some context, especially in a pre-social world, but also in a social world as well, advertising mandates the content that runs next to it. And what I mean by that is if you have a really hit top five show, you're not going to explore a theme in that show that makes your advertisers so upset that they stop spending money against the show. It has worked that way for a very long time. It's definitely changing, but fundamentally, most things that are put out into the world work that way. It is what is going to be acceptable to the brands that we want the support of will influence what is in that script. So that's one very direct way that advertisers are responsible for what makes it out into the world. And then the second way is the more obvious way, which is the content that we put out into the world. What our commercials look like, who is in them, what the storylines look like, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think that's what we tend to focus on is the creative that we have direct control over. And what I have seen personally from being in the US, let's say over the past 30 or so years, there is also a pattern of something emerging in advertising creative first that is very poorly received at the time. Through the repetition of that creative, it is then deemed normal or acceptable. And then you will see those themes pulled into television shows, books, other content that needs to be monetized around advertising. And so some things I point to are thinking about gay couples in advertising, thinking about transgender models or spokespeople in advertising, even in the US, who is so obsessed with body image, thinking about normal size people, which people call plus size, but they're not plus, they're normal size people in advertising. And I remember when I was a little girl, there was a Cheerios Super Bowl ad with an interracial family that made the news because it was such a scandal. And so that is one way that we can directly put out work that challenges what's happening today, that opens up those conversations, that makes them more acceptable, that gives permission for creators to dive into that area and still be able to create work that's able to be monetized and financially supported. But when I say I'm going to tie this back to internal inclusion, today we're in a moment where we're so hyper-focused on the end output, and we're so hyper-focused on, okay, is there at least one non-white person in this ad, that what we have is some form of representation, but we don't always have inclusion. And so one of the things that I have been kind of riled up about, let's say in the past 10 months, are ad creatives that show in a very unrealistic way interracial couples or families. The racially ambiguous woman with the successful white man. It is the Black man with the blonde white woman. It is an Asian character who is plopped into a situation or friend group or family, and they are the only one there in that commercial. And the reason I'm calling that out is there are deep nuances within each community of people. There are deep cultural norms and things that we carry with us, and that's a lens on how we view creative. And especially within the US, and especially with Black men, there has always been a conversation of, why is it so impossible to see Black love on TV? Why is it so tough for execs to just let a Black man and a Black woman be married and be the center of something? And so in our advertising rush to say, oh, wait, we need to pepper in someone who's not white into this ad, you could potentially be doing more harm than good. And the reason that you don't know that you're doing more harm than good is, who wrote the script? Who did the casting? Who conceived the strategy? What does that room look like? Was that room inclusive? Were there people represented from the culture in that room that you were trying to reflect in your spot? If the answer is yes, were those people encouraged to speak out and encouraged to challenge what you wanted to do? When they did that, did anyone listen to them? Did your perspective change? Did your decisions change? And so what we continue to see, and I think we have seen this with the DEI census showing that we haven't made that much progress on gender, is you can't teach diversity. There isn't, you know, a simple checklist for it. You have to actually live it and do it and really feel it and be committed to it. You can't shortcut your way to it. And so in order to get to that external product that's really great and resonates really well and lands the way you want it to, you've got to have your own house in order, and you have to have that internally before you can hope to do that in the right way externally.
You mentioned you can't teach diversity, but can you teach inclusion? One of the things you said, and I think it's so important, is it's not enough to gather a group of diverse writers and producers. They have to be heard. So how can we create, especially as you think as advertisers, what kind of environment do they need to put together so these creatives can do their best work?
Thank you for asking that. I think you can teach inclusion. My agitation to that is, does inclusion need to be taught, or do we need to stop being afraid of inclusion? And what I mean by that is, when I think about inclusion in my life, and when I think about inclusion for the agencies that I shepherd, it is pretty simple stuff around consistency, around when we're having discussions around performance, being very clear and specific and fair across the board, about not interviewing people and saying they're not a culture fit, but actually tying that to something specific that is an indicator of the job that they will do here. We have our own internal listening surveys to hear about the lived experiences of people here. And over and over, the things that I would say that you teach as part of inclusion, they're just common sense. It's just being a decent human. It's just being fair. The reason that it has to be taught in the corporate sense, and the reason that it is so difficult for so many, is because the way that we are financially incentivized in most places is in direct opposition to inclusion. At an agency, you are financially incentivized to do whatever you need to do to win a client's business, which means not actually speaking up if something doesn't feel off. It means allowing the client to pick out who their favorite lead is, even if they're picking that for reasons outside of how qualified someone is. When you win business, you have to run as fast as you can to staff it. And many times that is, you know, everybody call a friend or someone that you worked with in the past and let's try to get this account staffed. Great. That's how you have these monolithic, homogenous teams that are really susceptible to groupthink and don't come up with new ideas and innovation. And so I could go on and on here, but the point is, yes, you can teach inclusion. A lot of those things are things we know we should be doing anyway. The reason that gets hard is because in order to empower inclusion, we have to rethink our financial models, our incentive models, even how we partner with each other to design for inclusion. And I think that is the really tough part. It's tough for two reasons. One, because it's a lot of things that need to be undone, but it's also tough because sometimes it can be really hard to know where to start because there's so much that needs to be done.
I would like to wrap up this conversation thinking a little bit about where we are historically and where we're heading. You talked today about 2020 being such a disruption in history. There's more of a push for diversity and inclusion, at least in representation. And now with a focus on looking at how are our teams comprised. But what is ahead? What is missing? So what is the next stage we need to get at? And how can we get there? As we look at the future, what does Belinda see?
We haven't gone as far as we need to go. See the results from the global DEI census to understand why I say that we are not as far as we need to go. This work is really interesting because it does vary so much from country to country. And the US, given our historical context about being a slave superpower and then having a lot of years of segregation that we're actually still in, I find is much more advanced in some ways in this discussion and in some ways not. And so, sorry to keep going back to the census, but one of the things that I loved about it is there are many countries in the world that actually haven't had a discussion about gender yet. And so that census is going to be a really helpful instrument in opening that discussion. And that's a step forward. There are some places like the US where we've been trapped in unproductive cycles for a long time. My parents were actually DE&I trainers before I was born and when I was a child, and it's not that different. I would point those in the US to a book called Diversity Inc., which is incredibly illuminating. It touches on a major US lawsuit against Coca-Cola in the 1970s, and the things that Coca-Cola put in place under threat of having to pay out millions of dollars in this lawsuit to really change how diverse their corporation was. And the reason that I love that case study in this book is because it can be done. We know how to do it. We've done it before. We have success stories where we've made progress. But somehow we are caught in this circle of A, unwilling to acknowledge our history, and that we've had this conversation more than 10 times, and that we know what we need to do. B, feeling much more comfortable to put a public face on DE&I without really thinking through what that means internally and then following up there. But also, I think our attention span has really shortened, and inclusion is not something that can be a quarterly goal. Inclusion has to be a pillar of your business from here until forever. I have seen in my own life and via my work with the WFA, the World Federation of Advertisers, I have seen people coming to this work with new questions. And those new questions are already understanding that systemic change is necessary and already understanding that it's a long road ahead. But where can I start to have the most impact? Those questions used to be, where can I find Black talent? What is the next news story going to be? And how can I make sure I'm kept out of it? And I have now seen more people taking a more considered and longer term approach. And I'm really hopeful by that. With the people who are in high places, who want to do the good work, the amount of resources that we have now, and with the third pillar of some kind of consistent measurement and benchmarking, holding us accountable, I'm pretty hopeful. I'm pretty optimistic for the future.
You've been listening to Future Proof from Kantar and Said Business School. For all episodes and more information, visit kantar.com or oxfordfutureofmarketing.com. If you enjoyed this, please leave us a rating and a review and subscribe within your podcast app so you never miss an episode.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.